Blog Talk Radio.
The blackness. Keep on.
Also shoot me an email, and that email address is dinodeanshow@hotmail.com. We're going to have a Get It Off Your Chest Sunday like we always do, and this is the segment where we talk about any and everything, politics, what goes on in our communities, current events, you name it, we will definitely get it in. And I'm going to be talking a bit about these police across the United States. They have gotten absolutely buck wild, and they are definitely out of control. And I have a very special pre-recorded interview with a spectacular lady. Her name is Dr. Melissa Barber, and she's going to be talking with us about a wonderful opportunity to get a full-ride scholarship to the Latin American School of Medicine in Havana, Cuba. But at the top of the hour, our brother is with us, one of the baddest brothers on the planet, and it is the fantastic Tony Browder, and he's going to be talking with us about some of his latest findings with his excavation efforts over in Kemet. And with that said, welcome back to the show, Tony.
Good evening, my brother. How are you?
Oh, I am doing absolutely fantastic, and I appreciate you taking time out of your busy Sunday, and I know you're always busy, so I really appreciate it when you're able to come onto the show. And the first thing I want you to let the listening audience know is, tell us about the ASA Restoration Project.
Well, first of all, let me wish your listeners a happy fall. Yesterday was the fall equinox.
Yes, sir.
Which is critical to our relationship between the sun and the universe. So we are experiencing approximately 12 hours of daylight at nighttime, and we'll begin to move towards the winter solstice, the day of the least amount of sunlight, and that time frame is critical to the spiritual rebirth that the earth experiences and that we can also experience when we're in tune with not only the earth but the sun and the cosmos. And this is something that I've come to develop a deeper understanding of through the work that I'm doing through the ASA Restoration Project. The ASA Restoration Project is named in honor of our dearly departed ancestor, Dr. A.C. G. Hilliard III, who transitioned in Egypt, in Cairo, Egypt, on August the 13th, 2007. He had been speaking at the ASCAC conference in Aswan when he fell ill and died several days later. And to honor this man who meant so much to us all. I was given the opportunity to get involved in a project which is the excavation of two newly discovered Kushite 25th Dynasty tombs on the west bank of Luxor, Egypt. And in 2008, I created the ASA Restoration Project to honor my colleague, Dr. Asa Hilliard, and also to let our community know about the significance of this newly found discovery of these two Kushite tombs, and to raise funds to fund the excavation, conservation, and restoration of these two tombs, and to create opportunities for our people to travel to Egypt and participate in this excavation. And we've completed, this is our fifth year of working on the project, and we made some phenomenal discoveries, brother.
Well, Brother Browder, I want you to tell us all about it. And as a matter of fact, I'm just going to hand the show over to you right now. And this is officially the Tony Browder Show for the moment. So you just let us know what you found, and I'm going to get in where I fit in.
Okay. Well, first of all, let me just give your listeners some details. If they want to go to our website to get information of about the project itself, to contribute to the project, to sign up to participate in the project next year, they can go to our website, which is www.asarestorationproject.com, asarestorationproject.com. The two tombs that we're working on are two 25th Dynasty tombs of two Kushite nobles. The 25th Dynasty is the only period in traditional Egyptian history that contemporary Egyptologists will acknowledge was a black rule dynasty. Now, those of us who've been talking about the history of Kemet for decades know that that's not true, but this is part of the struggle that we've been fighting. But contemporary Egyptologists give us the 25th Dynasty because that's the period in which Africans from Kush, modern-day Sudan, came into Kemet with the specific intent of rescuing the land of their ancestors. Those were their words. They came into Kemet to rescue the land of their ancestors. And essentially for approximately 103 years, five different African rulers from one family were responsible for initiating the first renaissance in recorded history. They came into Kemet, they drove out the Libyan invaders, they drove out the Assyrian, who were their supporters, they drove out those Kemites who had sided with the Libyans and the Assyrians, and they reestablished rulership, African rulership, over the land of their ancestors. And for approximately one century, they rebuilt temples and monuments. They rewrote the sacred texts. They also began to bury their dead in Kemet. So what we have on the west bank of Luxor, right near the Valley of the Nobles, is initially we found my colleague, Dr. Alina Pistakova, in 2002, began looking for these lost tombs. And in 2006, she found the tomb of Karakamun. Karakamun was a priest, the first Ak priest of Apetisut. Apetisut is a temple complex that the Arabs refer to as Karnak. Karnak Temple, or Apetisut, is the largest temple complex ever built by human beings on the planet. It is where the Holy of Holies, or the ancestor room of the Netra Amen, resided. And so it was Karak Amen's job as the Ak priest every morning to say the oral libations to evoke the presence of Amen, the presence of the unseen spirit of God Almighty into his holy receptacle so that his spirit would literally inspire the 83,000 people who worked in this temple complex.
Tony, let me interrupt you just briefly.
Sure.
You talked about how those from Kush came in during the 25th Dynasty and fought off the Libyans and the Syrians. Who were the Libyans and the Syrians at that time?
Well, at that time, they were what we would classify today as a mixed-race people. They had some African blood, but they also had Asiatic blood. If we recall the history of Kemet, it was around the 15th Dynasty where Kemet was invaded by the Hyksos, the so-called shepherd kings, people from Asia or the area that is now known as the Middle East. And they came in and ruled just the northern part of Kemet for approximately 100, 150 years. And while they were there, they mixed with the indigenous population. They spread their seed, and they were eventually driven out by the 18th dynasty kings. But they still had a presence in that region of northern Africa, and they continued to struggle to come back into Kemet to lay their hands on the richness that they found there, the richness of architecture, the richness of history and culture and science and philosophy. So that really set the stage for this these terrorists, if you will, to continue to assault the people of Kemet.
That's a good word.
So during the 18th dynasty, that was the third golden age of ancient Kemet, the 18th and 19th dynasty, our African ancestors were forced to become an imperialistic nation. What that meant was that they were forced to begin to spend a large percentage of their resources marshaling an army to drive these terrorists out of Kemet, and they really went as far as Syria and Iraq and set up fortifications and left garrisons of soldiers, thousands of soldiers, in order to beat back any effort on the part of these foreigners to come back into the land and destabilize their nation. So this is a part of the history that, you know, very few people talk about, but if we look at it in the context of what's happening to Africa right now, this scramble for Africa. Once the Europeans came into Africa, then they decided that they wanted to stay, or they wanted access to the resources that were there. So this is a struggle that's been going on, brother, for millennia.
Absolutely. The call-in number is 646-200-0067. With us is the fantastic Tony Browder. Continue, Tony.
Okay. Well, the tombs of Karakamun and Karabashkin, the other tomb that we found that we have access to now is the tomb of Karabashkin. Karabashkin's tomb was actually the first Kushite tomb built in Kemet. Karabashkin was the mayor of Warset, the city that the Greeks called Thebes and that the Arabs now call Luxor. Warset was the capital of Kemet. It was called the scepter, the most select of places. It was tantamount to being the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C. It was the focal point of political power and spiritual power. So this man, Karabashkin, was the mayor, the governor of Waset, and he constructed the first Kushite tomb in Kemet. We don't know a lot about him because after he died and Kemet fell, the Kushites were driven out after the last king of the 25th dynasty, Tenutamen, was driven out. Then the Assyrians came in and set up a puppet government, and you had Kemites who sided with the Assyrians, who then came in and undid the great works that were done by the Kushites. They usurped these tombs. And as a consequence, the Arabs, who now controlled Egypt, lived in these tombs. They used them as their own private treasure boxes. They cooked in these tombs. They herded their animals in these tombs. So by the time that Karabashkin's tomb was discovered by Dr. Pistikova in 2006, it had already been destroyed, totally destroyed by the Arab family who had built a village in this area. The tomb
so
of
they
Rock
basically
the moon,
desecrated the graves of some of the mighty ones in Kemet. Did you say they had their animals in there and they cooked in there? It was a total desecration.
Well, the thing that we have to remember is that the Arabs who now live in Egypt are not the original inhabitants of that land. They came to that country around 648 as conquerors. So to the Arabs, to the Muslims who currently live in Egypt, they saw the ancient Kemites, our ancestors, as idol worshippers. That is why they freely and openly destroyed the temples and monuments. They used the outer covering on the pyramid at Giza to build mosques and bridges. So this is not their history. This is not their culture. These are not their ancestors. And the only reason, or should I say the major reason, why they are safeguarding these treasures now is because they bring them in billions of dollars every year.
Tourist dollars.
From tourism, as well as shipping these artifacts on exhibits all over the world. So it's a money-making venture for them. But if we look at the history from solely an African perspective, then what we can see is the struggle for Africans to hold on to that which their ancestors created. And so the tombs of Karakamun and Karabashkin were usurped first by the Assyrians, then by some of the Kemites themselves, then by the Greek, then by the Persians, then the Greeks, then the Romans, then the Arabs, then the British, then the French, and now the Arabs again. So we've been fortunate to have been able to discover the tomb of Karakamun, which disappeared from view in the 1990s when there was a flash flood which destroyed the pillars which supported the ceiling of these tombs. These tombs were built underground, some 20 feet underground.
Mm-hmm.
And so the tomb of Karakamun collapsed into the desert and disappeared in the 1990s. And the residents of the village that was built around these tombs began to use that crater in the earth as a garbage dump. So my colleague, Dr. Alina Pistakova, in 2006, began excavating in that crater, and she slowly began to find evidence of a tomb. And by virtue of the fact that the tomb was destroyed by this collapse, it really preserved the tomb and kept the villagers there from destroying it. So as she began excavating the tomb, she found this incredible artwork. She found Medinetra carved on the ceilings, on the pilasters, on the walls.
Wow.
And when I met her in 2008, she had essentially run out of funds to pay for the excavation. She could not get funding from her employer and other supporters and used her own money. I was introduced to her by an Egyptian colleague, and she gave me a private tour of the tomb. And as I walked through this sacred space and saw what she was doing, saw what she had uncovered, I made a commitment to her to raise funds so that this work could continue. And the vehicle through which we've been raising funds is the ASA Restoration Project. It's named in honor of Dr. Asa D. Hilliard, but also ASA is an acronym for the area in the West Bank of Luxor, Egypt, where these tombs are located. They're found in an area known as South Asasif, A-S-A-S-I-F. Asasif is the mountain range which separates the Valley of the Nobles from the Valley of the Kings. So our tomb is south of Asasif. So ASA is the Asa G. Hilliard South Asasif Restoration Project. And since 2008, we have raised over 1 million Egyptian pounds, over 175,000 U.S. dollars, to pay for the salary of the 70-plus workers we have there, to buy the materials to rebuild the tomb, the limestone material, and other products that we need in order to do the work there. And we have, for the last 5 years, taken 16 missions, 16 groups of volunteers from the United States over to Egypt. Over 60 people have traveled to Egypt with us over the last 5 years to work in this tomb as volunteers, as people doing registration, doing photography. So if any of your listeners are interested in joining us as volunteers and coming on our 2014 mission, they can go to our website, asarestorationproject.com, and there is a page there that gives them the details that they need to read and information that has to be submitted for an application, because our mission is a American-Egyptian mission. We work in concert with the Egyptian government. And so everyone who works on our mission has to submit an application and be officially approved by the Egyptian government so that we can continue this work. So this is all above ground. And everything that we're doing has been acknowledged by the Egyptian government. As a matter of fact, we were over in Egypt this summer. We were the only American mission to work in Egypt during this second revolution. We did a study tour to Egypt in July. We were the only Americans, although it was an all African-American study group, we were the only African-American tourists traveling in Egypt during the revolution. And brother, we, you know, we went there. We did not cancel our trip because
what was the revolution like? We all heard about the Arab Spring. What was that since you were over there?
Well, listen, brother. What it is essentially is the Egyptian people having the courage to do what Americans are too afraid to do, and that is to hold this government accountable to service the needs of the people. Right now, the U.S. government has been hijacked by these right-wing Republicans, the Tea Parties, and a few multi-billionaires who have bought the members of Congress, and they are holding this nation hostage. Right here in Washington, D.C., there is talk now about the Republicans in the House of Representatives holding up the budget and allowing this nation to go into default at the end of this month simply because they disagree with President Obama and Obamacare. So if the citizens of this country had one fraction of the courage of the Egyptian people, they would get out in the streets, they would protest, and they would force these elected officials to do the will of the people who elected them. But while we were there in Egypt, I actually spent an evening in Tahrir Square on July the 12th. Went down there with my Egyptian buddy. We walked around. We talked to the people who were there. And I saw entire families were there. And they were there to protest the Morsi government because what I did learn is that the Morsi government, the Muslim Brotherhood, is not very well liked by the majority of Egyptian people. But because of the fact that Morsi won the election fair and square, they decided to give him a chance. But what essentially happened was Morsi turned his back on the Egyptian people in favor of the members of his exclusive organization, the Muslim Brotherhood, who are interested in implementing Sharia law in Egypt. And the average Egyptian is not interested in going backwards to the 6th or 7th century. They have had a taste of the modern era. They have gone to school. They've got degrees. They've got education. And they're not interested in veiling their women or restricting the freedoms that they have fought for when they ousted President Mubarak. So they understand very clearly what they are fighting for. They're not fighting for their own selfish individual lives, but for the lives of their children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. And so, essentially, during the second revolution, General Sisi, knowing that Morsi had messed up in ways, I could spend an hour telling you about all the mistakes that Morsi made, and they gave him an ultimatum. Either, you know, change your ways or you're going to have to go. And Morsi acknowledged that he made some mistakes, but he refused. He refused to move in another direction. And so General Sisi then moved to arrest Morsi. And they charged him with crimes, and it was a list of crimes that he and his people had committed. And one of the biggest crimes, brother, one of the biggest crimes was when he fired all of the governors in the various territories within Egypt, and specifically in Luxor, where we're working. He fired the governor in Luxor, who was a very honorable man, very respectful man, and then replaced him with a member from the Muslim Brotherhood who had no political experience. And the people of Luxor, and this person that he appointed as governor of Luxor, was the number two man who in 1997, was responsible for leading the terrorist attack on a group of Japanese tourists who were visiting the Temple of Hatshepsut, and approximately 54 people of these Japanese tourists were murdered by this group. And
wow.
So this is the man that Mohamed Morsi appoints as governor of Luxor. So the people of Luxor got so upset that they placed a barricade around the governor's office and refused to allow him to come into the building. So after 5 days of the standoff, this appointed governor just threw up his hands and walked away and said, I never wanted the position anyway. And this happened over and over again within the Morsi administration. So the military and the citizens said, enough is enough. You've got to go. And they basically arrested Morsi and began arresting prominent members of the Muslim Brotherhood. And then on the 20 on the 26th of July. Again, Governor General Sisi asked the Egyptians if they were willing to stand by him and if they felt he was doing the right thing. And on that Friday, right after prayers, over 30 million Egyptians came out and demonstrated in support of General Sisi and the ouster of Morsi. That was the largest political demonstration in history. And so as a result of this mandate from the people, he then moved to arrest the other members of the Muslim Brotherhood and begin the process of taking control of the Egyptian government. So that's where Egypt is right now. And we were there in the midst of all of this, and I can say with no uncertainty that we were safe. As a matter of fact, brother, I am safer in Egypt today than I am in my own hometown of Chicago, Illinois. I am
and
safer in Egypt today than I am in Washington, D.C. You know, they had a mass shooting at the Naval Yard in D.C. on Monday. They had a mass shooting in Chicago at a playground on Thursday evening. You know, what's happening in the United States of America is senseless murders for no reason, for no legitimate reason whatsoever. But what's happening in Egypt is you have people fighting to regain control of their country, to wrestle it from the hands of religious fanatics and people who are intentionally moving their country backwards.
Absolutely. Tony, we're coming up against the break. And when we come back, I'm going to go to the phone lines. Somebody's in queue. And I want you to tell us about some of your findings during the excavation, okay?
Sure.
Very good. You guys are listening to the Dino Dean Show, Hollaback Radio.
We were a fairly conservative family in La Cañada, which is close to Pasadena and the Rose Bowl. My father was a federal judge, highly regarded. I was in the Peace Corps in Costa Rica, then I went back for 3 years of law school at USC, and then was a Navy JAG attorney for 4 years. Then I was appointed to the bench. I had the guidance of my father. I'd been a trial attorney for quite a while, and I just, that really felt like the right thing. It became immediately apparent to me when I was a judge, watching what was going on in my own courtroom, that we were churning low-level drug offenders through the system for no good purpose. There are mandatory minimum sentences, and there have been times in which I've known of judges, federal, state, are literally in tears because they know that this sentence is inappropriate. And so they would apologize to people, but as they're sending them to prison for 10 years, they know full well it really shouldn't even be a prison sentence, or maybe 1 or 2 years, but they have to follow the law. We, in the United States of America, contrary to virtually every country that I'm aware of, have focused on jails, focused on prisons. We lead the world in the incarceration of our people, both by sheer numbers as well as per capita. It's extremely expensive, both in financial terms as well as human terms. We have to get smart on crime instead of tough on crime. Probation, mental health facilities, strict accountability, quicker justice. Let's make drug treatment more available for people, and we won't need all of these prisons. We simply can't afford it, and it doesn't work.
My name is Heidi. This commercial is informational for you and your future children.
Hi, my name is Amari. I will be speaking about safety of our people.
So many children out there are in gangs, and it is your job as students to say no to gangs and yes to a great future.
So many children in the world have died from gang violence. More than 500 children have died from being in the wrong place at the wrong time.
So think smart, but joining a gang isn't a part of it.
Number 646-200-0067. On air with me right now is the fantastic Tony Browder, author, lecturer, Egyptologist. The brother does it all. Right now we're going to the phone lines. Area code 708-207. Talk to me, it's Dino Dean.
Yes, how you doing, Dino Dean and Mr. Browder?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I got a question. I've been doing a little research about the OMACs and in ancient Kemet, and the indigenous status of us being over here in the Americas, how do you tie in that correlation with the Olmec civilization and the so-called African Americans that we over here now, and the Olmecs and ancient Kemet? How do you tie that in together?
Oh, sure. Great question.
Great question.
I had the pleasure in 1977 of first hearing Dr. Ivan Van Sertima when he spoke at Georgetown Law School here in Washington, D.C. And he had just published his book that came before Columbus, The African Presence in America. And it made me aware for the first time in 1977 that the ancient Egyptians were black. Van Sertima, in his publication, provided documentation to show that Africans from the Nile Valley built ships, navigated the Nile River, Mediterranean Sea, and the Atlantic Ocean, and began coming to the Americas, interacting with indigenous people between 1200 B.C. and 600 B.C., that they made multiple journeys. I had the pleasure in the mid-1980s to travel to Mexico on three occasions, and two of those occasions I was there with Dr. Van Sertima and had a chance to visit all of the major Olmec sites, to see the heads, to see the temples, and get a better understanding of this culture and this pre-Columbian African presence in the Americas. Now, so if we look at Van Sertima's time frame, he said that the Africans who built the ships and came to the Americas came from the Nile Valley, came from Kemet, and they began coming as late as 1200 B.C., so as early as 1200 B.C., and the last journeys were around 600 B.C., which means that the last of the Africans from the Nile Valley to travel to the Americas were Africans from the 25th Dynasty, the same period that we're currently excavating in South Ossetia. Now, this is phenomenal because, there are five kings who constitute the 25th Dynasty, actually six kings if we look at that history correctly. But three of the most significant kings were Pianke, his brother Shabaka, and Shabaka's nephew Taharqa. Okay? Based on the research that we have unearthed at the excavation of the tomb of Karakamun, we have evidence that allows us to say with 80% accuracy that Karakamun was the son of Shabaka. We've been able to determine that Shabaka had another son named Heremaket, who also was a priest at Ipetasut. And I just recently found a piece of information which says that Tenutamen, the last king of the 25th Dynasty, was also a son of Shabaka. So we've been able to partially reconstruct the family history of Shabaka, and we've been able to show that his sons were princes, who had major roles to play at carrying out the duties at Ipetasut. And hopefully as we continue this process, we'll be able to provide more details about these Africans from Kush who ruled in Kemet.
Absolutely. 708, was that it?
I understand that the present-day Indians, they are from the Mongoloid race of people, and the Mongoloids came from another part of the world. And they came over at a certain date. I'm hearing that we predated these Mongoloid Indians, and that we are supposed to be the real indigenous people of North America and South America also.
Well, let me just say this, brother. A lot of people have said a lot of things, and you can say whatever you want to, but until you can back it up with concrete evidence, it's just words. Based on what we know about the migration of human beings out of Africa into Asia and Western Europe, what's been shown is that the people who we mistakenly refer to as Indians I migrated across the Bering Strait when it was still a part of the Asian landmass, came down through Alaska, through Canada, and populated the entire North, Central, and South America. And then it was later, much, much later, that Africans began coming over here in ships. So, you know, it's important for us to know our history, but we don't have to claim everything. And whatever we do attempt to claim, we need to provide concrete evidence so that we can speak truth about what we know to be a fact and not continue to perpetuate misinformation.
Very good, Tony. Now, Tony, tell us about some of the latest findings during your latest excavations over in Kemet.
Well, what we've done in 2010, we found the actual burial chamber of Karakamoon, an incredible discovery where unfortunately, his tomb had already been robbed by the Arabs who lived there, so we were essentially picking up the pieces. But we found his burial chamber, which is a wonderful edifice with a beautifully painted image of Nut on the ceiling. Karakamoon's tomb is 2,700 years old. It was built during the 8th century B.C. And painted on the ceiling is the image of Nut, and on either side of Nut are constellations. It's a star map, and this star map specifically describes the region of the cosmos where the soul of Karakamoon and the soul of all of the deceased whose hearts are weighed on the scale of Maat go to a specific region of the sky where they are to be reborn. And that region of the sky was known as Sahu. We know Sahu better by its Greek name Orion, the constellation of Orion. So we've got documentation for all of that in Karakamoon's tomb. We also have found in his tomb pyramid texts that were inscribed from the first tomb in Egypt, the tomb of Unas, the last king of the 5th dynasty. His tomb was the first tomb to have text carved on the walls. And that text it mistakenly is referred to as pyramid text, but there is no writing in any of the pyramids in Egypt. Pyramids were always situated over the tombs. So within the tomb of Unas is this text, which is mistakenly referred to as pyramid text. And this text is regarded by scholars as the oldest religious text ever recorded by human beings. It describes the salvation of the soul, it describes the judgment of the soul, and it also details the specific location in the heavens where the souls go to be resurrected, the souls go to be reborn. So we have a copy of that text in Karakamoon's tomb. We also have at least 70 different chapters from the Book of Coming Forth by Day, the so-called Book of the Dead in Karakamoon's tomb. His tomb has over 80 chapters. Some of them are duplicates, but over 80 chapters of the Book of Coming Forth by Day. And his tomb, which is a late period tomb, contains more texts, more sacred texts, than any late period tomb known, built by Kushites or Kemites. We also know, we had a conference in Luxor, Egypt last October, where we invited scholars of the late period of Egyptian history, the 25th and 26th dynasties, to come together and share their research. We also, that gave us an opportunity to showcase our discoveries from the tomb of Karakamoon. And we heard from a team of French archaeologists who have had a private concession at Karnak Temple, at Pet-I-Sit, for the last 100 years. They shared with the audience information that knocked my socks off. They said, based on their evidence, based on their research, two Kushite tombs, Shabaka and Taharqa, were responsible for building more chapels and more temples at Pet-I-Sit than any king in the history of Kemet. This basically just revises the whole history of Luxor, the whole history of Pet-I-Sit. This season, we worked 4 months out of the year between May and September. Typically, it's May and August, but we just closed the temple on the 12th of September. We closed for the season, and so we'll be raising monies and preparing to go back next season. And we made three major discoveries that I'll share with the audience. As a matter of fact, if your audience goes to our website, you will be able to see a link for a lecture I gave this past Wednesday, where I gave a report to the community on the work that we did this past year. The link can be found at ASARestorationProject.com and also IKG-info.com.
And let me ask you this, Tony. Can they see photographs during this lecture?
Photographs, brother. It's a PowerPoint presentation.
Okay,
very good.
You
got photographs, you got video, all right? So you can see it with your own eyes. The thing that I am proudest of what we've done over the past 5 years, is that we finished the excavation in Karakamun's tomb this year. And so we move forward with our efforts to restore his tomb. Our goal is, our mission is threefold: excavation, to remove the debris, and find artifacts which we will use to conserve the tomb. Those pieces of the tomb that are in fragile condition, we will conserve them so that they can be fully restored. And then the last phase is to rebuild the tomb. So what we've begun doing this season, what we did this season, was to rebuild the false door in Karakamun's tomb. Now, let me just explain to your listeners the significance of this.
Okay.
Every tomb in Kemet and Kush, every tomb has in the western part of the tomb, that part that is the furthest part away from the entrance to the tomb, that part that is near where the body is buried. The bodies are always buried in the west, because the idea is that the souls of the deceased will travel with Amen, and Amen was the name that was given to the sun when it set in the west. So the souls of the deceased would travel with Amen to the beautiful west, where they would be reborn. And so in the western part of every tomb is a door, which Egyptologists commonly refer to as a false door. That false door was constructed for the Ba of the deceased. And the Ba was depicted as the person, the deceased, head on the body of a bird. And that bird symbolically was to represent the soul of the deceased. And that bird had the capacity, now I want you to understand this concept.
Symbolism.
This bird, or the Ba, had the capacity to fly through this false door from the spiritual world into the physical world. So, in honesty, that door should not be called a false door, but a spirit door.
Mm.
It's a portal to another dimension of consciousness, time and space. So what we did this season, brother, we reconstructed the spirit door of Karakamun. And right in that spirit door, the main figure in the spirit door is a figure of Asar. And around that spirit door are three rows of offerings where Karakamun's associate, his fellow priests, are making offerings of beer and wine and food and bread to Asar. So Asar will accept these offerings from Karakamun and allow him to journey with him into the beautiful west, where he could be reborn. So what I talk about in the lecture that your listeners can see is the significance of the restoration of that spirit door for us. What we have done is to reestablish this portal, which allows our ancestors now have direct access to us and to help transform the consciousness of those who are ready to be instruments for good. Okay?
So, yes, sir.
And once that was done, brother, things started happening.
Okay.
We started finding things. We finished the excavation in Karakamun's tomb, and so we started excavating in Karabashkin's tomb. In the courtyard of Karabashkin's tomb, and we found this incredible stela that is incorporated into an altar. It's over 7 feet tall. It's got these wonderful carvings of Impu and the mummified form of Karabashkin, with a female figure kneeling before him, maybe his wife, and behind her are three priests One is burning incense and providing an offering to his body. The other is holding the instrument that is used for the opening of the mouth ceremony. And then the rest of the...
What's the opening of the mouth ceremony? What is that? I never heard of that.
All right, the opening of the mouth ceremony is a ritual that the priests do just before the body is put into the tomb, where they will take this instrument and they will touch the mouth of the mummy as they recite the words, which would then make it possible for his spirit to come back into his body and then walk with his body as he journeys through the 12 hours of day and the 12 hours at night, and makes his way into the Hall of Judgment, where his soul is going to be weighed opposite the scale of Ahad. It sets up the process for the judgment of the soul of the deceased, where they will stand before Asar and hopefully be judged Ma'at Keru, true of voice, so that they then can go and be resurrected in Sahu with Asar and become an eternal ancestor.
Okay, great definition. Okay, I never heard that before.
Okay, and it's a very important part of Kemetic rituals. As a matter of fact, at the funeral of Dr. Hilliard 6 years ago, last month, his family conducted the opening of the mouth ceremony on Dr. Hilliard before his body was taken to the cemetery. So it's a rite, it's a ritual that is designed to ensure that the soul of the deceased is able to have its memory restored, because, you know, death is a hell of a thing. It's a hell of a shock to your system. And so in Karakamun's tomb, as in the tombs of every person, king or no king, queen or noble person, are written the words that the soul must say as they pass through various gates. There's certain passwords that must be given to the guardians of each gate. There's certain passages that they must recite. And so all of this text was written on the walls of the temples. All of this text was written on papyri that were put into the sarcophagus and buried with the dead, so that the soul could have these notes, if you will, to say the words to ensure safe passage into the afterlife. And so what all of this really means, and as a result of my having spent 5 years working in this burial chamber of Karakamun, it lets me know beyond a shadow of a doubt that our Kemetic ancestors were not obsessed with death. That's the furthest thing from their mind. These African men and women had a profound understanding of life, and they knew better than we now know that life is eternal and that death is temporary. Death is a transition from one life to the afterlife, the life after this life. And that life is eternal, and this is something that those who deal with the metaphysical aspects of Christianity, the metaphysical aspects of Judaism and Islam, they know this. They don't necessarily talk about it to the masses, but this is something that they wholeheartedly subscribe to. It's just the masses of the people who have it all twisted and believe that we only go around once in life, and when we die, we go to heaven and hell and spend the rest of our lives there. Very few people on this planet believe that.
Absolutely. And I have a question for you from the chat room from Brother Anthony L., and he wants to know, do the Egyptians there perform Kemetic rituals right now?
The modern Egyptians? No.
Yes.
No.
They do not.
They're Arabs. They're Arabs, and they follow the Islamic burial traditions. Within Islam, you're supposed to be buried within 24 hours of your death. In Kemet, the process for making sahu is the Kemetic term which the Arabs call a mummy. It's a 70-day process. So there's this whole process that they have to do to cleanse your body, to remove the viscera from your body, and to prepare you for burial. And then before they put you in your casket, in what the Greeks refer to as sarcophagus, but the Kemetic word for that receptacle is Neb-Ankh. Neb-Ankh means the Lord of Life. That's the vehicle through which you become the Lord of Eternity. You live forever. And before they place your body in your Neb-Ankh, they perform that opening of the mouth ritual. to allow your ba, your soul, to now enter your body as the body is put into the nebank. The nebank is placed into your burial chamber, and it is then that you will go through the process of journeying through the 12 hours, 12 gates of the day, 12 gates of the night, and ultimately make it into the Hall of Maat, where you recite the 42 admonitions, and if you have found truer voice, you will be resurrected in Sahu.
Absolutely, and I have another question from the chat room, Tony, and this is Anthony L. again. He wonders, do you feel that the ancient Egypt will rise again one day? I'm assuming he's talking about reincarnation.
Well, look, what I know and what I accept as reality is that those ancestors are waiting for us to come into our right mind so that they will have adequate bodies that they can possess and move through to live again. You know, these ancestors can only come when there are vessels for them to inhabit. But as long as we're, you know, eating the wrong food, as long as we're acting, you know, crazy, then they don't have vehicles that they can work through. We are our ancestors. We are the receptacles through which our ancestors live. And if we knew that, if we understood that, then we would change our thinking, we would change our behavior. We would not be committing the atrocities that we commit in Chicago and Philadelphia and New York and Detroit and all these cities. We wouldn't be acting crazy if we knew who we were. So part of what, you know, our mission is the excavation and restoration of Karakamun's tomb, but the other part of our mission is to restore the consciousness of our people so that we can change our thinking and then become the willing vessels to which our ancestors will speak and do their best work.
Absolutely. And, Tony, tell us about the IKG Cultural Resource Center, too.
IKG is an organization that I established back in 1981 after I returned from my first trip to Egypt. I created this entity in order to have a space that we were in control of, where we can teach our history, our culture. We can have forums, lectures, and seminars. And so it has evolved to become the IKG Cultural Resource Center. We're located in Washington, D.C., and it is there where we hold our meetings, our lectures. We conduct our Egypt on the Potomac field trips. Are based from that location. We do the field trips the first Saturday of the month. And that field trip is an activity where we take people on a bus tour throughout the city where we show them the physical evidence that proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that the people responsible for creating Washington, D.C., mistakenly believed themselves to be the reincarnation of the ancient Egyptians. And they literally sought to recreate Egypt on the Potomac River.
And you said mistakenly believed this, correct?
Oh, yeah, because, see, you know, these European Masons believed based on evidence they found when they moved the Tekken or the obelisk that's at the in Central Park behind the Metropolitan Museum. When they dismantled that Tekken, which had been standing in Alexandria, Egypt, after it had been taken from Waset by the Romans and then reestablished in Alexandria, as they were dismantling that Tekken, they found in the base of it implements which they said proved that masonry began in ancient Egypt. Right, so they then began to espouse this belief that they were the reincarnation of the ancient Egyptians. So the whole idea behind the creation of Washington, D.C., which was the first in 1791 when they began the process for creating Washington, D.C., it was the first planned capital in the modern era. And the plan was to literally recreate the spirit of the ancient Nile Valley here in the Potomac River Valley. And, you know, our field trip or my book, Egypt on the Potomac, clearly lays out the evidence. And I have proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that the so-called Washington Monument, the tallest obelisk in the world, when it was finished in 1884, that structure was built not to honor George, first president of the United States. but it was actually built to honor Asar, first king of ancient Kemet, and the evidence is inside of that structure, and I have proof of that in the book Egypt on the Potomac.
Very good, Tony. You have been so informative, but before I let you go, I want you to tell us about your efforts to get the U.S. Postal Service to honor Dr. John Henry Clark with the postage stamp.
Well, in the U.S. Postal Service is headquartered in L'Enfant Plaza. L'Enfant Plaza is named after the Frenchman Pierre-Charles L'Enfant, who came here in 1777 to fight in the Revolutionary War, and he was tapped by George Washington to design the interior of the federal city. This city of Washington, D.C. was comprised originally of five different jurisdictions, but it was Benjamin Banneker who was responsible for doing the celestial observations in order to determine the boundary of this 10-mile square, which was to become Washington, D.C. And so the U.S. Postal Service's headquarters in L'Enfant Plaza, at the end of L'Enfant Plaza is Benjamin Banneker Park in Benjamin Banneker Circle. So we have found that the presence of African people has been so marginalized here in D.C. that we initiated a letter-writing campaign to the U.S. Postal Service to honor Dr. John Henry Clark, who was a phenomenal historian, and that in order for the U.S. Postal Service to consider creating a commemorative stamp of any person, any deceased person, they have to receive at least 100,000 letters of request. So several years ago, we initiated the letter-writing campaign where we're encouraging schools and just regular citizens to write one letter a week for a month to the U.S. Postal Service. Again, you can go to our website and find information. You can find a copy of the letter. You can basically take that same letter and type in your name and address and send it to the U.S. Postal Service. This is one way that we can honor those courageous men and women who have fought gallantly to help restore our historical and cultural memory.
Absolutely. Tony Browder, you have been absolutely fantastic. The information has been phenomenal. And once again, before I let you go, second time, let people know how they can donate to the ASA Restoration Project again.
Sure. Well, listen, let me say this. The other thing I forgot to tell you about our discovery, 3 weeks ago today, as they were doing cleaning at the excavation site in preparation of closing the site, we discovered a cave. And in this cave, there were a series of tombs carved into the walls, okay, of this cave. They stopped counting at 27. So we have found what we believe to be a middle-class Kushite burial ground. So that changes the whole landscape of where we are. Karakamun's tomb and Karabashkin's tomb were the cornerstone of this burial ground where Kushites, those Africans who came to restore the land of their ancestors, who lived in Kemet and who said that they wanted to be buried in the land of their ancestors, were all buried in this area. Now, we stopped counting at 27 tombs, all right, and we had to shut the site down for the season, but hopefully beginning next year, we will get the concession to excavate and explore these tombs. So it may be more than 27. It may lead to other things we don't know. So this means
right.
that this project that we thought was limited to two tombs has just expanded beyond, you know, beyond our wildest dreams. And so we're going to have to advance our fundraising efforts. We're going to open up the door to get more people to come over. We're going to need more volunteers to assist us. So I encourage your listeners to go to our website, asarestorationproject.com, asarestorationproject.com, or they can go to our ikg-info.com website where they'll get a link to the ASA Restoration Project. And you'll find a link there that will allow you to make a contribution, a tax-deductible contribution. We are a 501c3. And I am encouraging people to make a $120 a year contribution. That's $10 a month,
right,
to support this effort. and we give regular reports of what we've done. Again, you go to our website and you can see the presentation that I did just this past Wednesday, Report to the Community, to let our investors see how their investment has paid off.
Absolutely, Tony. You're absolutely fantastic, and I do appreciate you so much taking time out of your Sunday to hang out with me and the rest of the Dino Dean family. You have a good one. Be safe, and I'll be calling on you soon, okay?
All right, brother. Thank you for the important work that you're doing. And, you know, everyone has a role to play. My request is that you find what it is that you do best and do it to the best of your ability until the day you die.
Yes, sir. I'm going to take that to heart, Brother Tony. You
All
have
right,
a fantastic day.
All right. Take care. Hotep.
Bye. Hotep. Tony Browder, guys. One of the best in the business, fantastic gentleman, and today my cup runneth over that the brother was able to come and hang out with us today. And make sure you check him out in Hidden Colors, too. He did a fantastic job in that as well. But we're going to take a brief break, and we'll be right back.
What if you could designate someone to go to work for you? What if you could have a designated person show up to hear your economics professor drone on like a plane engine for 2 hours straight? Or if you could designate somebody to go to that family party where your relatives will surely pinch your cheek and tell you how much you've grown since they saw you last? Well, you can't. Whether you like it or not, you're going to have to show up to work, listen to your professor, and put up with your great Aunt Betsy talking your ear off about her dog. But you can designate a sober driver to get you home safe at the end of the night. I could have. I wish I did.
Drunk drivers kill someone approximately every 48 minutes in the United States. These deaths can be prevented easily by designating a sober driver at the beginning of a night out drinking. Make the right choice. Designate a sober driver. Visit drivesober.wordpress.com for more information.
I'm Wayne Brady, and I've got something that will truly revolutionize your life. It's called exercise. It will get you from here to there, allow you to spend time with your family and meet new people. Oh, cut inches from your waistline, even help improve your self-image. Sexy. So when you've got to choose between moving around or lying on the couch, choose exercise. Call the Will Rogers Institute today to learn more about this exciting new activity. Exercise is available in all 50 states and the District of Columbia and comes in 28 great flavors.
Only you can make me happy. Happy.
Welcome back to the Dino Dean Show. The call-in number is 646-200-0067. Once again, the call-in number is 646-200-0067. And we're going to a segment that I started about a month ago and got some good news to tell everybody, real good news. And I'm trying to find my cue-up music. Just give me one second. I got so much stuff going on this week. We're going to go to our Tell Me Something Good segment in 1 second. Do, 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 do. Here we go.
Tell me something good.
This is our Tell Me Something Good segment, and this is the segment where we talk about good things that's going on in our community as well as around the world. Aquifers found in Kenya could supply water for the country for the next 70 years. The discovery will bring drought relief to the rural northern portion of Kenya. 10-year-old Asia Newsom has become Detroit's youngest entrepreneur. Asia's company is called Super Business Girl, and she sells candles. Award-winning journalist Ronald E. Childs has been named executive director of the Chicago Defender. The Chicago Defender is one of the oldest African-American newspapers in the United States. Linda McGill Bozeman is the owner of Cedar Concepts Corporation, and she's the only black woman to own a chemical marketing company in the United States. Annual revenues are at $20 million a year and expected to triple in the next 2 to 4 years. Somebody's going to be a real lucky guy if they get to marry her. Former NBA great Irvin Magic Johnson has launched a movement called Friends of Magic to combat the national high school dropout epidemic. And this concludes our Tell Me Something Good segment. And this segment was inspired by Haru G. Duenas. So check out his Facebook page, Positive Black Stories. And if you have some positive stories you think we should know about, shoot me an email, dinodeanshow@hotmail.com. I'm going to play an interview that I did a little bit earlier in the week, and this is some really good news. And this is an interview I did with Dr. Melissa Barber, and she is a graduate of the Latin American School of Medicine, and she's going to be letting us know how those 18 to 25 years old can go to medical school for free. You heard that, my favorite word, for free. Real good information, so I want you guys to check this out. And this is me and Dr. Barber earlier this week. And with us right now is Dr. Melissa Barber, and she is a graduate of the Latin American School of Medicine, and she's going to be telling us about a great opportunity for young people to get a full scholarship to study medicine in Havana, Cuba. Welcome to the show, Dr. Barber.
Thank you very much for having me, Mr. Dito.
Oh, absolutely. It is a pleasure. The pleasure is all mine. And before we get started, please let the listening audience know a little bit about your background.
Well, I'm a native New Yorker. I was born and raised in the South Bronx. I currently reside in the South Bronx. I am a world traveler, so I've been traveling through a lot of places. I've done undergrad in Pennsylvania, Ursinus College, Collegeville, Pennsylvania. And then prior to that, I was in a boarding high school, Wyoming Seminary in Kingston, Pennsylvania. And then once I graduated, I actually came I went to Havana, Cuba, and I actually studied at the Latin American School for about 6.5 years there. And then I actually made my transition back to the United States. Not currently in residency, but have done a lot of things, and currently actually one of the program coordinators for the medical school at the IFCO Pastors for Peace organization.
Very good. Well, Dr. Barber, tell us about the Latin American School of Medicine. What's that all about?
Well, the Latin American School of Medicine actually started as an idea. And what actually happened to form the school was back in the late 1990s, the hurricanes that devastated Nicaragua, Honduras, Haiti, and Dominican Republic actually allowed Cuba to send several doctors for emergency relief, as they usually do throughout the world. And when they realized that they were in these countries and they were providing the medical support and the health infrastructure that was needed, they realized that once they pulled out of these countries and some of the most rural areas of these countries, there would be no medical care whatsoever for the surrounding populations.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, they were just, Fidel Castro, he really thought that, wow, you know, we could make a big impact on these surrounding countries and sister countries if we were actually able to train their residents to be medical physicians and send them back to their own country in these rural areas to provide the health care and the health infrastructure that's needed to sustain them. And so with that, the idea of the medical school was actually formed. And the first, in March 1999, that's when the official academy was turned from the formal naval academy that it was into the Latin American School of Medicine. And now, today, the program has grown that you actually have over 124 different countries,
oh, wow,
30 nations of Africa and the Americas that are actually now studying in Cuba at and through the Latin American School of Medicine.
Well, that's fantastic. And how are students in the United States eligible to study medicine in Cuba? The U.S. and Cuba have such bad relations. How did this come about?
Well, that came about because usually every year they have the Congressional Black Caucus and the Congressional Latino Caucus would actually have delegations where they would visit Cuba and see several of the entities, like medical entities, social entities, educational entities of Cuba. And during a conversation that they had with Fidel, several of the caucus members actually made mention of the areas that they particularly came in from and the health disparities amongst students trying to get into medical school in the United States for those areas. And they, you know, they let him know, like, really for black and brown people, it is very difficult to get them into medical schools to actually be physicians in our communities. And he, you know, let them know, like, wow, if that's such an issue, you know, because we would definitely send our doctors there to those communities. However, because of the blockade, I know that that couldn't take place. But he said, you know, I think of something, why don't we do something so that we could actually have those students from these particular areas come to Cuba. I'll provide the scholarships and the training for them. They could come for the 6 years for their medical career, and then we would send them back into the state so that they can actually practice in these rural communities. So that actually started with a caucus member that was from Mississippi. When he actually came to speak to the UN, he actually mentioned that again. And then in May of 2000, he began to talk about, you know, what he was willing to offer to several of the states from where those caucus members were. Then he actually did a talk in Riverside Church in New York City. And when he did that talk, he actually mentioned again the prospect of giving out the scholarships, but he offered the scholarships not only to the Mississippi Delta region, but he opened it up for all U.S. students to actually apply to this medical program. Fortunately, it was a wonderful idea. Everybody applauded and they clapped, but there was really nobody willing to actually take up that offer because of the political relationship and the environment, the tensions between U.S.-Cuban relations. However, IFCO Passes for Peace, having a long-standing relationship with Cuba and doing the Cuban caravans each year, they decided that they would actually pick up the program and facilitate it, and then they were designated by the Cuban government as the entity that would facilitate the application process for all U.S. students to go to the medical school in Cuba.
Well, tell us about IFCO, because they're paramount in this process.
Of course. IFCO, the Interreligious Foundation for Community Organization, was an ecumenical organization agency, you know, whose mission had always been to help forward the struggles of oppressed people for justice and in several communities, not only in the U.S., but internationally as well. And they had always done, you know, caravans to countries like Nicaragua, Latin America, Cuba specifically, to actually protest the blockade in terms of Cuba. But they had always done social justice work in the U.S. and throughout the U.S. and forming groups and organizations and having them come together to fight and struggle for, you know, the community. And because they specifically had contacts with Cuba and had always done the Cuban caravans, which still happened every year, where they gave peace aid each year and collected peace aid to go down to Cuba, they had this relationship, this positive relationship with Cuba as an organization that always stood up for justice, social justice, and had always provided the communities that link, you know, to always foster better relations and normalize relations with Cuba.
Okay, very good. And Dr. Barber, tell us some of the criteria for young people to be able to participate in this program.
Well, first of all, you have to be a U.S. citizen. you have to be between the ages of 18 and 25 at the time of the completed application process. You must have pre-med science courses at a college university level. They have to be it has to be 1 year of biology with lab, 1 year of general chemistry with lab, 1 year of organic chemistry with lab, 1 year of physics with lab. You also have to have, you know, a commitment to practice in some of the poorest and the most underserved communities in the U.S. after graduation. We try and make it so that most people who are applying for the application process are from the humblest and neediest communities throughout the U.S., and you must be physically and mentally fit to actually, you know, do a medical school program in Cuba.
Okay. Does one need to be bilingual to participate?
No, we actually don't. You don't need to be bilingual. Most students who do not have the Spanish language under their belt, they'll go through intensive Spanish courses anywhere from 3 to 6 months, and they'll pick up the language and actually do courses in Spanish so that they can also pick up the Spanish to be fluent enough to start their first year of medical school.
Well, let me ask you this, Dr. Barber. So you went down just speaking English?
No, I actually spoke both.
Oh, okay. Well, how difficult?
But I have several friends who did go down not speaking any Spanish at all, who are now currently fluent in Spanish.
Fluent. So that's the other side of the coin. You'll be a doctor and also come back bilingual, and I think that's great.
Yes.
Now tell us about life on campus. Is it a big party? Are you more dedicated to your studies?
Not at all. Not at all. Most people, I don't know, for some reason, people think Cuba, Havana, I'm going. It's going to be me studying on a beach next to some palm trees. Get that idea out of your mind from the very beginning. Medical school, whether you go in Africa, whether you go in Asia, wherever you go, medical school is one of those professional degrees that is a very hard career. It is very rigorous. It demands and it expects. And so you have to be ready and know that when you go down to Cuba, you are going to be immersed into a medical school program. No holds barred. So, you know, there's enough in Cuba. They focus on being a whole person. So, you know, there's not going to be complete, you know, overwhelming times where you don't get a break and get to breathe. So, you know, you definitely have to do the balance of studying and making sure you're making the grades and doing what you need to do, but then you also have to have that free time to kind of breathe and do the things that balance you out when you're very stressed. Campus life, when you first go to Elam, the first 2 years are done on the Elam campus, which is a converted Navy base. So you're going to be living in like barrack-like situations. And the classroom sizes are usually, when you get into your little groups, they're usually anywhere from about 5 to 12 people. But then when you have large sections of courses like, you know, the anatomy or physiology, you'll be broken up into lecture sizes that are a little bigger because they come together. But most class sizes range from either 5 to about 12 to 16 at most of students.
Okay, that's great. So these young people are going to have to buckle down, handle their business, and appreciate the opportunity given to them, correct?
Exactly. Exactly. It's definitely work.
Okay. And is it difficult to communicate with loved ones back in the States?
The communication is a little different, so you won't be able to communicate as much because of, you know, the blockade and the communication level. However, there is internet access for the students. You know, you can also go to local, you know, hotels in the area that also provide more communication access. There's phones on campus where you can call your families. It's a little pricey, so you're paying about $2 a minute.
Ooh-wee.
But you can definitely call your family. In the dorms, they actually have phones in which your family can call to Cuba and speak to you at any time. So the communication has definitely increased from the time that I actually studied in Cuba. But there's still, a lot of ways to go to get certain bandwidths that will allow you to do the Facebooking and the Twittering. So that is not necessarily something that you can do readily, but there is access to that.
Okay. And can parents come to Cuba and visit their children?
Yes. Most of the students that
that's great.
Most of the students that will be going down, if accepted, will have a travel license. So they will actually have a travel license and legally be traveling back and forth between Cuba and the U.S. And under that license, their parents are also allowed to visit them.
I'm going to make my 9-year-old go because my great-great-great-grandfather is from Cuba. And I've always wanted to go to Cuba, so she is going to be a doctor, and that's where she's going to study. I'm telling you right now.
Or you can actually do what we do at IFCO. One of the things that we do is we try to have delegations where we bring different delegate groups down to Cuba to visit and see several other programs that are in Cuba and several institutional entities that are there. And our organization particularly makes a stand to not have a license when we're traveling to Cuba because we're protesting the blockade against Cuba. So
okay.
You can be like us, and you can choose to do that as well.
I want to be in on that. Now tell us, what does the scholarship include?
The scholarship includes free room and board. It includes all 6 years of your books to study. It includes 3 square meals a day, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And you will be responsible as a student for your own toiletries and your own maintenance, but pretty much everything is provided. They provide you with uniforms as well to study. Girls, you have your white coats, your lab coats, and skirts, and sometimes they give pants, and then males have their white coats and their pants.
Okay, that's fantastic. And upon graduation, you come back to the States, and you're debt-free, correct?
Yes.
That is so spectacular. Come back
unless you have undergraduate debt. But in terms of medical school debt, you are free of debt.
That is absolutely fantastic. And Dr. Barbara, could you please tell us about some of the misnomers about Cuba? I grew up in the era when Cuba is the enemy, you know, the commies and all of that old craziness. What's it like in Cuba?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to establish that they're not communists. It's a social democracy. And we also have to realize that most people going into Cuba are very warm. One of my phrases to describe Cuba has always been that it's black Harlem speaking Spanish.
Oh, okay.
And most people laugh at that, but it's the truth. You get to Cuba and you see so many Afro-Cubans, black people walking around who look like your aunts, your uncles, your nieces, your nephews, and they're speaking Spanish. And their culture is exactly like yours, except they're speaking another language.
Wow.
So for me, getting to Cuba, it was almost like going home because I met people who looked like my family members, who looked like my aunts, who looked like my cousins, and embraced me as such. And
Absolutely. So
I think in that even that understanding of many people, like, you know what, we understand that, you know, the governments always have their issues, but at the basic level, people want the same thing.
Oh, yeah. I agree with you wholeheartedly. And people all over the world travel to Cuba,
exactly.
Correct?
Exactly.
And tell us about the medical facilities in Cuba. To my understanding, Cuba puts out some of the finest doctors in the world.
Yes, they do. So we have currently, like, Cuba is very well known for their medical infrastructure and their health care. And they will be, for the longest time, one of the best healthcare systems, even if you comparing that infant mortality rate, which is less than most countries in the world. And for this little island to be known as that, obviously you know that there's something going on there that's great. So one of the things Cuba is at the forefront for is developing new edge technology that is affordable for people in the Latin American sphere of reference. They have developed technologies with cancer treatment. They have developed technologies with vitiligo treatment. One of their new centers is the histotherapy center that actually treats vitiligo. So many people, famous included, have definitely inquired about Cuba and their treatments of vitiligo. I know that Michael Jackson, when he was alive, was actually one of those people. You have, they are on the forefront of developing technologies and treatments for several cancers. So they are definitely at the forefront doing a lot of things in this little country and developing means that can actually be great resources at cheap prices for people who cannot necessarily afford a pharmaceutical-driven society like ours.
Absolutely. And upon you graduating, how difficult was it for you to practice medicine in the States?
Well, in terms of practicing medicine in the States, it has its challenges. When you transition back from Cuba to the U.S., there's a series of steps that you need to take to actually become a resident in a hospital here and practice here. So one of those transitional things that need to take place is to take STEP exams, and those are the USMLEs, which are the United States Licensing Medical Examinations. And there's several exams. So there's a step one, there's a step two, CSCK, and once you're in residency, there's a step three. So once those exams are taken, which are very difficult, which are very pricey, you can actually apply for to residencies within the United States. Now, all of our students, when they graduate, are on different levels. Some choose to actually take those licensing exams throughout their careers in Cuba, you know, if they have the time and the resources. Some actually choose to wait until they graduate. So depending on where you are and what your transition is, you may actually come out having some of those exams done already. It can then apply to residency, or you may have to wait a while, study for those examinations, take them, and then apply to residency. However, at this point, we do have about 92 graduates of the program. About 29 of those are already in residency. We have 4 doctors that have already graduated out of residency and are actually practicing now or in fellowships. So we also have graduates that are in other countries now practicing as well. So, you know, that's to show you that the program is definitely a success, that there, you know, we definitely can transition back into the U.S. and any other community and practice medicine.
That's wonderful. And the Latin American School of Medicine, it is an accredited school, correct?
Yes, it is. We also, several years ago, we also did the accreditation through the California State Board. So every U.S. citizen that is going over to Cuba is definitely accredited to practice in any of the states throughout the U.S.
That is super, super news. And before I let you go, tell young people a reason why they should consider the Latin American School of Medicine. The whole interview was that, but just sum it up and give us a closing statement, please.
Well, I think that if you are a student that is interested in being a revolutionary person and changing yourself, your community, you would definitely benefit from going to Havana, Cuba, going to the Latin American School of Medicine and coming back and being a person that is responsible for social change as well as environmental change and as well as also being a person that can institute different ways and different perspectives of how to view medicine as a whole. I know that my training has definitely prepared me in a way that most physicians here are not prepared. I have been prepared for disaster mitigations that allowed me to actually go to Haiti and do medical missions when the hurricane hit and devastated that nation. I am a mom of a child who's autistic, and me being in Cuba has taught me how to not only advocate for her, but actually treat her when many doctors who I've faced have taught me, have shown me that the way they practice medical care and caring for people who look like me is not necessarily always the correct way. So if you are very much interested in being a doctor, if you are definitely interested in impacting your community and actually being the voice for the poor and those that are underserved, this is definitely a program for you, and you will get so much more out of it than sometimes what you're putting in, because you will realize that doctors here, when you come back home, say, wow, you've been trained in Cuba. I know you're one of the best, and I know you've been trained to be the best. So, you know, keep that in mind when you definitely consider coming out to apply for this program.
Absolutely. And Dr. Barber, before I let you go, give us the website where people can find more information.
You can go on the website www.ifconews.org. Under the medical school tab, you can definitely click the frequently asked questions, the curriculum plan. You can request an application if you are eligible for the program, and then you can take it from there. And our cycle, our application cycle, is about to open up on September 30th until March 15th of this year if you want to apply for the following year to attend medical school.
Very good. And that's www.ifconews.org, www.ifconews.org. Dr. Barber, thank you so much for hanging out with me and giving us some very, very valuable information. I appreciate you tremendously, and you enjoy the rest of your evening.
You too. Thank you so much for having me, Mr. D.
Not a problem. You have a good one.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. That was Dr. Melissa Barber, and she gave us some really, really good information. I was very excited that she was willing to come on the show and give our young people something good to hear. We have a lot of very highly intelligent young people in our communities, and I just wanted to share this information. And whoever it was, one of my Facebook friends, I saw it posted. I don't recall who it is. Thank you. Thank you so much for posting that. So I reached out to IFCO, and they set me up with Dr. Melissa Barber. So that was some really good information. And let's find another way for our young people, because it's very expensive to go to medical school here in the United States. And if they can go down there to Cuba and handle business and come back as doctors here in America, I think that's what it's all about. But we're going to take a brief break. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Dino Dean Show, Hollaback Radio.
1 in 8 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer in her lifetime. 1 in 35 women will die from it. But you don't have to be one of them. Perform breast self-exams regularly and see your doctor if you notice any changes. Early detection saves lives.
Breastfeeding doesn't suck.
You'll feel way less crazy.
It makes you skinny. It burns 500 calories a day.
It helps you bond.
No periods.
It's free.
And it's so good for the baby's brain.
Less flu.
Less allergies.
It lessens the threat of childhood obesity.
It seriously reduces your chance of getting breast cancer.
It reduces the risk of childhood cancer.
It could save the U.S. billions of dollars a year in health care costs.
Whip them out.
Whip them out.
Whip them out.
Breastfeeding. It's what your tits are for.
Welcome back to the Dino Dean Show. The call-in number is 646-200-0067. Once again, the call-in number is 646-200-0067. We're going to our Get It Off Your Chest segment right now, and I'm sure you guys have heard about this story about Jonathan Ferrell. He was a football player for Florida A&M University, and he was shot dead by the police. Real tragic story, and beyond tragic, it's a real sick story. This young man was in a car accident and had to kick his back window out to get out of his vehicle, and he stumbled to a woman's home, banged on the door, and was trying to get some assistance. The lady ended up closing the door on him and calling the police. It was at 2 in the morning. I'm not really upset with the lady. If somebody comes banging on a door and there's a single woman at home by herself and she doesn't know who the individual is, I can't too much blame her. 2 in the morning, so he left, and when the police came upon him, this is allegedly he ran towards the police, and the police unloaded on him. One particular gentleman unloaded on him, shot at him 12 times and struck him 10 times, and the young man died there at the scene. And the NAACP is questioning whether or not race played a role in the shooting. Well, of course it did. Let's just keep it real today. And I have a question for everybody that's listening, as well as those in the chat room. Have you ever heard of a black police officer killing a white citizen? I've never heard it. Maybe it has happened, but it seems to me as though that these white police officers are just using our people as targets. And Public Enemy stated it best: fear of a black planet. And that's exactly what we have going on here. This young man was in a car accident, and when he went towards law enforcement to assist him, he was gunned down in the streets. And the officer's name is Randall Carrick, and he has been charged with voluntary manslaughter. That's a rarity for a policeman to even be charged with anything. And the police chief in that particular town, he is a black man, more melanated person of color, whatever we want to call it. And he took his badge, and he was charged. So I have to tip my hat to him, because rarely do you see a policeman, after gunning down one of us, ever get charged. They literally do some little bogus investigation and then eventually let the man go. And this is a heart-wrenching story, because he was a loved young man, and he had just moved to that area, Mecklenburg, South Carolina, and he was there working two jobs, you know, trying to provide for his family. And it's real sad to see something like this happen, but we have to stand up as a community and demand better, because it's just open season on our people. But right now I'm going to play a clip of Jonathan's mother and brother, and they're going to tell you a little bit about him, the type of young man he was.
Jonathan was a very happy, outgoing person. All my kids are good kids, but Jonathan was so loving. We were sitting there trying to think of something bad about him, but there was nothing we could think of. I can't even think of a bad thing he had done as a child, no more than anytime he gets sick or anything, he wanted to sleep with me, because he loved being near his mother.
As a brother, Jonathan has been, you know, as a brother to me and brother to so many others around the community and around the state of Florida that have came in contact with Jonathan. He's always been a great person, always been somebody who was willing to help no matter what the situation was, always cared about somebody, no matter if he didn't know him, always was willing to give, always willing to help, was always happy no matter how upset or it's very hard to even make him upset. In any situation, but Jonathan was one of the greatest man I ever, you know, came in contact with. Even though that's my brother, that's somebody that I dearly love, and I know everybody else who came in contact with him through high school, through elementary, and people who probably never even really met him, who have heard word about him, never heard nothing negative or bad about him. But he was always a great person, always have a smile on his face, and always loved making people happy. So that's something real small to sum it up.
You know, this stuff just breaks my heart, watching our people gunned down in the street like dogs. And we wonder why a group like NWA would come out with a song called Fuck the Police, because that's how a lot of people feel. See, the white community doesn't understand that these policemen aren't officer friendly to us, not in the least bit. They're nasty acting. They treat us shabbily and don't mess around and have a wave brush or something in your hand. They'll shoot you dead without a problem, and it'll be swept under the rug 9 times out of 10. And this story just it really got underneath my skin, because if you go online and check him out, handsome young man, young in the prime of his life, and to have a mother bury her son because he got in a car accident and had the audacity to expect that law enforcement would help him out. It's sick, and I would really like to see our people come forth and start using these cell phones. You know, we have to get these quote-unquote law enforcement on film, and I'm going to share another story. Haru Moore, hold on. Yes, I do have a link for this story. I'll put it in the chat room. Just give me a second, brother. I'm going to share another story with you as well, where luckily the young man had cameras available to save him from going to jail, because I'm just doing this right. And let me get this going on. Let me get this in the chat and I can continue. Boom. Here we go. Bing. There you go. But luckily this young man was able to get the police on film doing something absolutely dastardly. And I'm going to pull the clip up right now. This is unbelievable. You just can't make this stuff up. And it's something that many of us have seen, many of us always knows happens in our communities. But let me pull it up right now. Let me pull it up, because this stuff is just something else. And this happened to a young man, I believe, in New York.
Good evening, Jim. The use of undercover informants is a common police technique used to bring charges against suspects not inclined to deal directly with cops. But often, the undercover agent is a shady character facing his own charges. That makes him motivated to give police what they want, whether the suspect has done something wrong or not.
Donald Andrews Jr. operates a so-called smoke shop on Mohawk Avenue in Scotia. It sells incense and other smoking paraphernalia, legal stuff, but material that might also be repurposed for other illicit activities. Scotia and Schenectady County police became suspicious and targeted Andrews' shop, sending an undercover informant in twice in March. The second time, Andrews' attorney, Kevin Rebrand, does play-by-play that appears to show the informant planting, then photographing crack cocaine that led to Andrews' arrest.
Donald turns, he comes in, places the crack on the counter, crack which under federal sentencing guidelines would get him 4 years in jail. Under New York State law would get him 2 to 7 years in jail.
There are 7 cameras in plain view in Andrew's small store. Here's a second clear angle.
He walks in, places the crack cocaine on the counter.
Members of the Schenectady chapter of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference viewed the apparent framing of an African-American businessman and were outraged.
It was a setup, and I believe that he was racially profiled and targeted, and it would be easy for them to say that he was selling drugs because he was black.
Now, neither the Schenectady County Sheriff nor the Scotia Village Police Chief were available to be interviewed about the apparent planting of evidence. By phone, the sheriff acknowledged proper procedures were not followed, but denied his investigators purposely framed the suspect. The sheriff blamed the informant, who has taken flight. Andrews was arrested, but released, when he was able to get police to look at the multiple camera angles. He's taken the first step at filing a lawsuit and was not made available today by his attorney. Bill Lambden.
Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You have a young brother who has pulled himself up by his bootstraps, and they want to plant drugs on him to land him in jail. And like you heard in the clip, they were trying to give this young brother years. See, the cards are stacked against us, and people don't want to understand it. Well, actually, they don't really care to understand it, because they figure it's our problem. But if the rest of the nation will finally wake up and see what has been happening to us on a regular basis, has now spread like a cancer to the rest of the country. And I'm talking about Big Brother watching. I'm talking about those that want to peacefully protest being picked up and harassed by police. See, white America is getting it too. They're getting it full on. And it can't be denied that the police state has transferred from our community to the rest of the nation. But the sad thing is, they still don't want to understand our plight. They still don't want to understand what goes on with us and our community and wonder why so many of us have to take the stance of speaking out and speaking up. See, family, if we don't talk about these things, who will? If we don't talk about these things, our young people are lost because they're voiceless and they're trapped in a system that literally is herding them into the penal institutions here in America. So we have to talk about these things, and we have to have plans of action to get these things reversed. This is a necessity because I'm quite sure most of the people in my chat room, you're pretty much well-established. You're doing your thing, and this isn't for you. It's for your babies. It's for my children. So we have to come up with a course of action, and one course of action that I would like to see us take, man, we see these police doing something crazy. Whip them out, and I'm not talking about tits. I'm talking about them cell phones, and we start filming. That way we can save people that are being bum-rushed by the police. That way we can save our young people from going to jail. Pull those phones out and do what needs to be done. Don't just use them to put pictures on Facebook. Don't just use them just to text and send little sextings and whatnot that we have going on. These pieces of technology are a valuable tool for justice. Valuable tool. If that man in this story that I just played did not have surveillance in his store, he'd be locked up right now. He'd be locked up right now, and they would. And you know these prosecutors, they don't give a damn about justice. They just want to win the case. Let's just keep it 100. So that brother would have been locked up. His family would have been missing him. See, we live in a real dastardly society, and white America does not want to understand it, but that's okay. There's going to come a time, and this is just my personal prediction, there's going to come a time when poor whites and blacks are going to have to work together, because if they don't work together with us, they're going to perish. We already know how to survive. If you refuse to come forth and fight with a group of people where you have the same interests, and what kills me is how poor whites vote against their interests, all in the name of white supremacy. All in the name of white supremacy. I want to be supreme so much that I will vote and think counter to what's good for me and my household. That's a sickness. That is a true sickness that is running rampant through the Caucasian community. They would not want to be with us so much that they'd rather starve. And that's something else. And that's a hell of a mindset for a group of people to have. That's a hell of a mindset to figure, I so much can't stand these Negroes. I so much can't stand them. And the myth of them being a horrific group of people, I'd rather vote against my best interests just to say I align myself with another group of white people, when that group of white people could care less about you. They don't give a damn about you. You're a debt slave too. You're nothing more than a debt slave to them. And we're nothing but energy for the machine. Nothing but energy to keep the machine going. And this is where a lot of us many times make the mistake of thinking we always have to do something. The great Dr. Phil Valentine said something so cold-blooded in one of his lectures one time. He said the way to bring this thing to a grinding halt is inactivity. Don't do anything. Don't participate anymore. I'm taking my ball, and I'm going home, and I quit. I'm done because I can't stand this crap anymore. And if the people of this nation were to stand up, just like Brother Browder stated the people of Egypt did, and demand something better, this thing could be turned around overnight. And this isn't just happening in Egypt. It's happening in, what's the name of the country, Greenland. Man, those people snapped. They got the doggone international bankers locked up. They said, man, you can't just capitalize and monopolize all of the resources, and we're going to sit and live in squalor. See, white supremacy is slowly winding down if you know how to read between the lines. And our brother, Brother Mugabe in Zimbabwe, loved that brother to death, is setting it in motion. And I want to see the others, the other leaders in Africa, take his lead. White supremacy has to come to an end because it's an unjust system, and it is a system designed to literally kill the planet. They will take the resources and literally suck the blood out of the earth for dollars. Now, how sick can you get? But I'm going to go on to another quick little blurb about our good buddies, the police. And this was a hell of a story, too. I'm going to pull it up right now. Brother just walking down the street. And let me play this for you, and we're going to have to bring this show to an end today. Had a lot of good stuff for us. Brother named Bobby Wingate.
The last time Bobby Wingate walked down this road, he says he called 911 to protect himself from the police.
He gonna get out of his car, run up and grab me and punch me in my jaw.
Yeah, he parked his car right here by this curve.
He gonna talk about, do I really want to fight him? I ain't do nothing wrong.
Right there where that car at, by that tree, that's where the football tackled me at right there.
I'm talking to the police now. What am I doing?
I need to find you back.
Okay.
The conduct that is evidenced in those two files, the transcript and the 911 recording, is not only breathtaking, it's outrageous, it's disgraceful.
Wingate's civil attorney, Andrew Bondarude, says his client was a target of racial discrimination. According to court papers uncovered by First Coast News at the federal courthouse, Wingate was walking down the road in December when a JSO police officer stopped and asked him to talk. When he told the officer he was running late for an appointment, the officer cited him for walking on the wrong side of the road.
What did I do? Nothing. Walking down the street, minding my business, trying to go...
According to those court papers, the officer then hit Wingate in the face and engaged his taser. That's when Wingate called 911.
Good old Florida again. You know, I'm still boycotting Florida. I don't know about you guys. I'm not planning on going back, and not just because of the Trayvon Martin incident. The people in Florida are nuts. Them people in Florida are crazy. Those policemen and the whole system down there is so anti-melanin that it is outrageous. This brother walking down the street, minding his business, gets accosted by a policeman and attacked, tased, and beat up. He had to call 911 to get the cops off of him. You just can't make this stuff up, family. But with that, I'm going to bring this show to an end because we're getting a little bit late into the show. And I did not get to do my today's Black History Facts. I apologize. No, you know what? I'm going to do something, though. I'm going to do our old school cinema clip of the week before we go. I have to do that. I didn't do it for the past couple of weeks. Now, you should be able to get this one. Now, this is a good one. Pretty good movie, too. Check it out.
And Frosty, stay good. Anime, come on. This cake real good.
Anime, just take the cake, please.
What movie is that from? Anime, just take the cake, please. I'm going to do my countdown. 5, 4, somebody, I know somebody knows the name of this movie. 3, 2, 1. What's Love Got to Do with It? Got Ike kicking the hell out of Tina in that movie. It was something else. Oh, my God. My man, Larry Fishburne, man, he's a scary dude in that movie. I would never, want him to be nowhere near my family. He was whooping a lot of ass in that movie, and he was nuts. But with that said, I'm going to bring this show to an end today. Much love to the chat room. Double A, double B, double C, my brother, Anthony L., Brother Haru Moore, Paris Walker Sr., Sister Setta, and everybody else that's in the chat room. And I'd also like to thank all of the callers that called into the show today. Without you guys, there is no me. I appreciate all of the love and support you give me every week. And I want to thank Dr. Melissa Barber giving us that fantastic information on how to get a free medical degree. And also the man of the hour, the fantastic Tony Browder. He dropped it like it was hot today, and I appreciate him tremendously. And like somebody said in the chat room, you go check this one out in the archives. Brother threw down for us, and he handled his business and gave us a fantastic report on what he's doing over in Kemet. But I'm going to end the show like I always do with a song. And real jazzy, brother, we all know who he is. He almost sounds like a terrorist group, Al-Qaeda, but it's Al Jarreau. And the song is After All. Wonderful song. I will talk to everybody next week. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday. I'm getting ready to watch the Bears.
Is the night in armor bright, faithful and true?